Okay, so I think actually the end of that lovely talk by Miguel and the questions are a perfect kind of transition to my talk. So nominally, in honor of the title of this conference, I try to have like a piecing together the flat hologram as my title. But in practice, what this is going to be is a 30-minute, I guess, advertisement for this research program, Celestial Holography. And so maybe the first place that I should start is this celestial conjecture, which is we're trying to say that we can describe scattering in asymptotically flat spacetimes as being encoded in this codimension 2 dual that lives on the celestial sphere. And what I personally really like about kind of the nature of this program is that you can have kind of two definitions of what you want to call celestial holography. The one that I'm going to present in this talk, and I think the one that is more, like, I guess, reasonable to really assert, is that it's kind of this history of, I guess, developments in trying to look for a holographic description of spacetimes with vanishing cosmological constant that kind of emerged from various insights that we have from the asymptotic symmetry group of asymptotically flat spacetimes being very, very large. And so with more symmetries, more constraints, we're motivated that way. But I also want to pause and think that to some extent, and like I hope that the goal of this program turns into this, is you're looking up at the night sky, and you know that whether it's studying black hole evaporation or studying, I guess, insights distilled from string theory in the form of the ADS-CFT correspondence, that you expect there to be this holographic description of gravity, of quantum gravity, and in particular of quantum gravity in the real world. And so hopefully by the end of the talk, we'll be able to give another appeal very similar to what Miguel did, which is it's very interdisciplinary, but what I like about celestial is that rather than needing to know a lot of different disciplines in order to be able to make these conjectures, we instead are kind of trying to just unite a bunch of people also interested in starting from 4D and encoding or understanding the holographic nature of that space-time. So before I then like keep blabbering, I want to point out that I guess the going along the theme of like, the more legitimate version of what I want to call celestial, it's really this timeline for the past like 10 years of kind of research developments. And so the goal of this talk in particular is going to be to really go through this timeline. And so in particular, what I want to emphasize is that this understanding of this flat space dual is coming from a bottom-up approach. And only recently, through a lot of, collisions of basically people understanding the same symmetries from different viewpoints, has it turned into something where there's some kind of glimpse at a top-down construction, which is fun, but it's still very out there compared to like the nice nature of like the ADS-CFT correspondence for various reasons, which we'll touch on later. So basically in this talk, I want to get through this timeline and the various milestones that kind of led us to, in particular, kind of the weird things about the flat hologram being this codimension 2 description, motivating that, as well as to what extent we can really use various 2D CFT machinery, say in the 4D bulk. But let's get through it. So I have 30 minutes, and I'm going to probably put too much time into the first part, which is really back in the day, the 2013-2014 time frame, where coming out of Schrödinger's group, I think one of the first results that really like led to this program is this notion that the soft theorems are going to be equivalent to Ward identities. And so I think it's worthwhile to actually go through a little bit of the derivation of this statement, precisely because I want to later refer to like soft charges, hard charges, and asymptotic symmetries and whatnot, and I would lose people if I didn't spend some time here. So our starting point is as follows. We're looking at not just flat spacetimes, but asymptotically flat spacetimes. And so once you put some matter in your spacetime, even if you have zero cosmological constant, you're no longer going to just have a flat metric. And so there's a class of solutions, which I'll call asymptotically flat spacetimes, which for some nice matter configurations and falloffs, will then have a kind of generic or in some sense a standard like a way of quantifying the degrees of freedom near the conformal boundary of the spacetime for these asymptotically flat spacetimes. And so in particular, if I was looking at just Minkowski space, I have this doubled Penrose diagram. Maybe I shouldn't be doing the doubling, but later there's a statement of antipodal matching that I'm, I guess, happy to leave it there for. Even for this class of asymptotically flat spacetime, so long as I don't have a black hole, I have the same asymptotic boundary. And in particular, one thing weird about asymptotically flat spacetimes as compared to their ADS counterparts is that this boundary has no components. And so I tried to put a little bit of a code on the bottom for the Penrose diagrams, but I feel like a lot of people here would be familiar with them. But the point that I want to emphasize is that whenever we're talking about radiation, or we're going to ask questions about, how these in and out states for my given gravitational scattering process are prepared, I'm going to be able to think of things as living on these null boundaries. So the question of what is asymptotic symmetry group is something that has a much longer history. And so in the 1960s, Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzer, and Sachs were trying to, maybe people can correct me, they wanted to find, maybe they were hoping to find the Poincaré group, but then if you did, you would either if you want to have physical spacetimes with radiation, you don't want to over-constrain things, then those boundary conditions would actually open up not just maybe what you'd expect is the global isometries of Minkowski space, of the background, if everything was perturbative, but really for these solutions to these asymptotically flat spacetimes, you have a much larger symmetry group, which I'm going to go to in the next slide. So basically, once you pick a gauge that's trying to get rid of just your gauge redundancies, what you find is that near null infinity, Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzer, and Sachs have this nice gauge where basically going out at R, large R, fixed U, Z, and Z bar, you're going along a null geodesic. And there's a nice way to parameterize the different degrees of freedom here. So in particular, besides the, usual expectation of flat metric and then some Bondi mass, you have radiative data in the ZZ component, and you have various other, angular momentum is in this angular momentum aspect here. And the point is that you can specify freely this shear as a function of the retarded time coordinate U and the angular directions. And given that, and then the value of the bonding mass and the angular momentum aspect on one fixed value of U, you have your solution. And then you can go order by order in R in the bulk if you wanted to look deeper here. Now, the point is that that class of falloffs that you're looking at that correspond to these basically spacetimes that allow radiation, but hopefully don't have there's some U restrictions on the U component behavior of these of the shear, so that you don't have infinite amount of energy radiated, for example. These guys are preserved by the following residual diffeomorphisms, and in particular, the residual diffeomorphisms include basically free functions. So F can be a function of the celestial sphere, not just the four that we're used to for translation invariance. And similarly, the ability to do a Lorentz transformation gets enhanced too to this notion of superrotations. And for the rest of this talk, the ones that I'm going to talk about are where Y is going to be holomorphic. So basically then from there, you're basically co-opting this beautiful machinery that a lot of people have studied starting from the 60s, and then also a lot of the Brussels group talking about these canonical charges. You have an expression for the charge for these asymptotic symmetries, and then you can use your constraint equations, so basically Einstein's equations restricted to null infinity, and various integration by parts and manipulations, to really split that charge into terms where each of them are really acting on the conformal boundary. And so the reason for doing this from the point of view of talking about the scattering problem is that I want to be able to use, or especially if I want to compare to scattering amplitudes, I want to be able to relate these charges that are deriving as this codimension to, say, bonding mass or angular momentum aspects mirrored in a certain way near spatial infinity, in terms of data that I'm using to talk about how I've prepared my scattering states. And so later in the talk, I'm going to be mentioning a soft and a hard charge, so I just want to point out that they're there. And in particular, the soft charge is linear in the gauge field, and also it's this U integral of something, so it's a zero mode. It's going to capture a zero mode of the shear. And so then what one could do is if you wanted to say, well, okay, I have this asymptotic symmetry story, I know how I want to act with my charges and vary the data at future null infinity, what does that mean in a perturbative scattering sense? Well, I can also just look at the mode expansion of my gravitational field, and with various manipulations of basically plugging in the mode expansion, going out to null infinity, you get this nice feature that wherever you are in the night sky compared to where the scattering process is happening, the momentum of that graviton had to be pointing towards you, so there's this nice localization, and you're left with basically that the shear at a given point on sky is the Fourier transform of what you would normally say is your A's and A daggers, preparing your momentum eigenstates in your momentum space S matrix element. So, good. So basically in the previous slide, we had the charge, we've turned it into a soft and a hard part, and the soft part is something now we can extract because we have each of these expressions for the shear in terms of your A's and A daggers. Now, separately, we have another result from Weinberg in the 1960s telling us that insertions of a very low energy, either like gauge boson, like a graviton or a photon, has a very universal form when plugged into an amplitude. And so, for example, we know that if you have some scattering process and you have one additional soft graviton, you're going to have a pull coming from the fact that this momentum Q has in its energy, right? So basically, I have an on-shell set of external states, and I get this extra propagator, which gives me this 1 over P dot Q. And that guy is going to be the leading singular behavior as I take this extra leg soft. And so in particular, you now have in the momentum space picture a universal form of the soft limits, and similarly, the term that appears in the canonical charges when written in terms of the radiative phase space was a very low energy integral. And so basically, just by plugging in these mode expansions into your original conjectured Ward identity, you show the result that Andy was after, that these soft theorems are equal to Ward identities. And so I've said all these words, but just to point it out, you have some notion of the canonical charge someone gave you, and then you're splitting it using just the constraint equations, and then you're plugging in the mode expansion, you're plugging in the soft theorem, and you're matching that to how the hard charges like act. And in particular, later we're going to talk more about the fact that these hard charges are kind of analogs of like the Anik operator, various operators that have nice symmetry properties that have been studied in matter CFTs on their own, which is going to be how this story kind of bridges to a lot of other exciting aspects of the QFT and strings literature. But the one thing I want to point out here is that kind of there's two insights from this program. The one thing is that I can just plug in perturbation theory, the expressions for the charges in my S matrix element and see that there's a Ward identity. And the second thing is that if I really want to have a reason to match in and out, so this notion of separately studying the asymptotic symmetry groups at future or past null infinity, I would only match them if I had a reason to think that there is a diagonal symmetry group. And the way that it goes about mechanically is that there's some notion of antipodal matching where the behavior of the fields for these solutions near the past to future null infinity and the future of past null infinity are related. And so that was an insight that I think was only motivated more and more in hindsight by others. So thanks to Andy for that. I don't want to go into too much more detail because the point of the last part was to really emphasize or just define a lot of the different quantities I'm going to take for granted later in the talk. But it is worth mentioning that these notions of the soft observables are things that are actually observable. So the soft theorem, the part that is like the linearized part of the graviton, those modes of the metric can be measured in different ways. Now, obviously, if you're going to try to take this like very low energy mode, it's going to be below any cutoff of your like, calorimetric detector. But you can kind of imagine fun experiments where, in principle, there's, they say, a shift of two particles when gravitational wave passes. And sure, we can still debate about the time scales for my actual measurement. But there is a sense in which you can go out and infer what would the memory effect observable be in actual like astrophysical settings. And so the cool thing about it is that there is a notion of an experimental check of at least the validity of the asymptotically flat assumption when it comes to describing the physics around a region of, like, say, a gravitational inspiraling binary system or whatever you're looking at. So that's kind of fun. So what I want to kind of point out is that you have these individual connections, and the first kind of example of this pattern of things was kind of fully put together by Strominger and Jibayeda. But the cooler thing about it is that it's two things. One thing is that there's value in really merging different subdisciplines. And the second thing is that once it's a pattern, you can repeat it. So let me talk about the first part, because we already kind of gave credit, hopefully enough, to Weinberg and Bonnie Vandenberg, Metzer, and Sachs, and Zolovich and Polnarev, who are studying, and in some sense, I guess you could say that there's context to finding the connections. I'm sure there's other instances where it was understood that the soft theorems would affect the waveforms, et cetera. But basically, the nice thing about celestiallography, it has and has continued to be valuing the kind of nexus of different research programs. And then the second example of why the IR triangle is cool is that because this pattern is really just looking at a Fourier transform or looking at various soft theorems, you have a lot of other examples of corners of the triangle and you can really push it. And so, for example, the one that I enjoy the most is when you have this new subleading soft graviton theorem, thanks to Cacciazzo and Strominger. led to a new memory effect, as well as a kind of proof that there's a superrotation symmetry within perturbative scattering amplitudes. And then from there, you can manipulate the soft charge to be a 2D stress tensor, and that pushes us to the boost basis, which is like the formal statement of the celestial hologram. And so it really is from this kind of asymptotic symmetry origin and like merging of different disciplines that we went to this proposal for this celestial holography. So let me now be a little bit more concrete with this notion of how the 4D picture is leading us to a 2D picture in the context of the soft physics. So already you might be like, great, we have an infinite number of symmetries that should constrain scattering that might be interesting on its own. And that led to this whole like notion of this soft hair story and other kind of statements about dressings and IR finite S matrix elements. But for me, the interesting thing is that I can turn those soft charges into currents. And so in particular, for a particular choice of superrotation vector field, you're seeing that the soft charge that you're inserting, because of the form of the soft theorem within an amplitude, will look like I have basically inserted a stress tensor, a 2D stress tensor in particular. But the only subtlety here is that those weights wouldn't really be just diagonalized unless I go to like Rindler energy eigenstates. So it boosts in the collinear direction for where the particle is. And so what's worth pointing out is that basically there's two notions of equivalences here. There's a soft theorem being equal to a 4D Ward identity, and then there's a reinterpretation of the 4D Ward identity as a 2D Ward identity. And so the first equality is useful because that's a sense in which you can have used the soft theorem, use Weinberg's results, to take these independent, say, future null infinity and past null infinity analyses of the asymptotic symmetry group and show that they're really observed in scattering. And then the second part of it is interesting because that motivates basically trying to see how would I best write this hologram. In particular, because I'm interested in scattering, there's something nice about the codimension 2 description because there's one celestial sphere and all of my in and out stories are like acting on both of them. And we'll get to that a little bit later. So now there's a picture that is on the cover of Andy's book, roughly, that there's a 4D soft mode that I'm going to treat as a 2D current, and I can try to map the rest of my S-matrix elements to the celestial sphere. And so in particular, the notion of the 4D amplitudes being a 4D correlator is just a massaging of the LSE formulation. And so underlying this derivation of the soft theorem equals Ward identity, I needed to be able to know how when I do some manipulation on my gravitational field, how the S-matrix story was related to the position space story. And so conveniently, you can see that stripping off the poles when you look at like the Fourier transform of a position space correlator can also be implemented by just going to the boundary in the right way. And so there's an extrapolate dictionary in the sense of like normal like ADS-CFT, where now the power of R here is related to the bulk scaling dimension of the field. And then whatever I'm doing in the U or V directions is just manipulating the choice of phases. But now the kind of conjecture that comes out of looking at the soft theorems and trying to make them look more like currents is that I do want to look at this boost basis, which was those Mellin, or like the u to the power kernel there for that smearing in the u coordinate, as opposed to a Fourier transform to go to momentum space. And so at the level of just kinematics, it's not that bad. Basically, all I'm saying is we have a Lorentz invariant theory. And so long as you have Lorentz invariants, you can organize your scattering states in terms of boost eigenstates. And so the power then, of course, comes when you know that you actually have this full asymptotic symmetry group. And so then it's the analog of looking at, say, Virasoro multiplets as opposed to global conformal multiplets in the 2D context. And in this case, we have super translations too. So we have a very large set of symmetry multiplets that once we kind of understand how to handle this description, it should help us with any eventual like bootstrap type thing, but it's too far ahead. So now the statement that I want to just change my basis over is really just, again, a kinematic statement. And I can go about doing this by just doing the appropriate integral transform of my S matrix element. So again, if I'm just taking the same S matrix object and looking at it in different bases, then the momentum basis, I didn't have to do anything from that's where I'm starting from. But to go to the boost basis, I need to do a Mellin transform. So I go about and do that. And then I naively start to fill in my holographic dictionary by literally just translating things. So I do the integral transform on a bunch of things on the amplitude side, and then I tell you that's what it looks like on the correlator side. So in particular, if I take very seriously, like what does it mean to talk about the S matrix as the celestial hologram, the notion would be that I want to basically use the CFT data to talk about, to construct my S matrix elements. And so that's quite different nominally than doing perturbation theory in the sense that I'm not trying to just a bunch of Feynman propagators and use my local interaction in terms of my Lagrangian to build things up. I want to understand the strict collinear limits of scattering and use those to, and the symmetry groups to like bootstrap the rest of the amplitude. So I think it's fun to see that that's definitely rearranging how we would describe scattering. But in the silliest or simplest sense, I can just go back to the splitting functions that I have in amplitudes. So I have two massless particles, and the collinear limit are going to split off to another particle. I can take the momentum state splitting function, do my Mellon transform, and I get an OPE. So I get the OPE between the single particle states just from the S matrix elements, and then push from there. So in particular, these beta functions that appear just from the kind of kinematics of the powers of the energies appearing in that splitting function have poles in certain places. And so if I now kind of am overconfident about the fact that there is this 2D CFT description, then I might try to really push that machinery further. So one thing I might try to do is, okay, I have a 2D system where I actually have a kind of cheat that I can do because I really had a third direction. And so the nature of having this extra null direction is that for every particle I had in the bulk, I now have a continuous spectrum of fields in my 2D description because that's what the extra dimension was for. Now, on the one hand, that makes it look like a very sick 2D theory, but it also has a positive side, which is that, okay, I can tune the dimension. And so certain features, like certain null states that might exist for particular 2D theories, I can just make exist by tuning my conformal dimension to the values of the conformal dimension that would give me some primary descendants. And now the notion of like the Hermitian conjugation of the Lorentz generators coming from the fact that I want my S matrix to be unitary doesn't guarantee that these primary descendants would decouple. But at least in the context of like MHV amplitudes, there are certain situations where it looks like they do. And if you just, let's say they do, you kind of like close your eyes and go forth with the 2D radial quantized description, then for each of these soft graviton modes, which are basically picking up the powers and the energy as you go soft to each order in omega, you now have a little tower of basically polynomials in the z-bar coordinate, for example. And so now, not only am I going to treat it like a 2D CFT, I'm going to treat it like I can complexify things and treat z and z-bar independently, and then have a bunch of currents that are holomorphic. So one should be wary about all these manipulations, but the fun thing is like, let's see how far we can go with literally just, let's make it as 2D as possible. And so you go about and do that, rescale your generators, and with basically using the radial quantized bracket here, as if it was just a bunch of currents living on, like holomorphic currents in the z-coordinate on your celestial sphere, you get this really cool symmetry algebra that's like much, much richer than what we started with. So to make to emphasize here, from the asymptotic symmetry group, we had a notion of infinite number of symmetries coming from the angle dependence. And so I can take my space-time, I do a global translation, I actually have like no background, like change in the background metric. I have now an infinite number of different ways of like take the directions of the night sky, independently translate them, and I have a Ward identity. And the only difference between the kind of standard symmetries you're used to in this one is that there's kind of a flux balance law where there's a soft graviton inserted and not just doing the motion on all of the hard particles. This notion of infinite number of symmetries is like another level. So basically you're saying that at every order in the soft expansion, I have some sort of symmetry currents. And you would never even try to go through that if you hadn't seen that the soft theorems kind of looked like they were 2D currents. And so that's kind of neat. But where have we seen these before? And this is where celestial is, again, a merger of different disciplines. So for example, if you just say that I think one of the most interesting results that kind of kicked off, I guess, reinvigorating this notion of the boost basis was the 2021 result by Alfredo Guevara, Himwich, and Strominger and friends, using the celestial OPE to find larger symmetry algebras. And then the Twister people came in and say they know what they are because they've seen these in the Poisson diffeomorphisms that you have for the fibers on in your Twister space. Similarly, the twisted holography people said, oh, look, I have a 2D chiral algebra. It's the same one as you have. And then if you say that the point of celestial CFT was that I am going to try to match things from the bottom up, I'm going to tell you what the symmetries are, and you're going to find me a top-down dual that has those symmetries. Well, that's what the twisted holography people gave us. So thanks to Kevin, Natalie, and Tool, they have an example of a theory that is coming from some weird twisted version of this like ADS-CFT like correspondence, which it lives on Bern space, so it's very much strangely not physical, but they've fulfilled the mandate of give me a theory with a top-down construction that has these symmetries. So that's pretty cool. And it's all because we're basically looking at the same objects from different directions. Now, I think there are a lot of natural questions that from the derivation of the asymptotic symmetry story, and also from these holomorphic collinear limits, you should be worried that the LW infinity doesn't seem quite on the same footing as one where you have a Ward identity and you know what the symmetry charges are. But that's fun to have these kind of different natural questions and also kind of take into account what is it that you want to see as fundamental. Is it that these enhanced symmetries that you get from like the loop W1 plus infinity are there for certain theories like self-dual sector? Or some good approximation to kind of perturb around or whatnot. But the fact that they kind of gave you from this bottom-up kind of conjecture a top-down construction is already very satisfying. And then there's different ways of looking at these guys kind of give you some insights onto how we want to hold on to it. So what I want to now, basically at this point, I've talked about kind of the main parts of the celestial dictionary in the sense of we're going to try to bootstrap amplitudes from soft and collinear limits. So we need the collinear limits, and we need to know the spectrum. The spectrum is this continuous set of dimensions for each of the single particle states. And then you want to be able to look at the multiparticle states by putting more of them together. And so what's nice is that it's always good to kind of take a step back and look at what you were doing to create the celestial CFT. And in particular, this notion of taking my 4D my 4D correlation functions whenever the bulk is perturbative, taking me to the boundary to effectively be going on shell with the objects that I'm looking at. And then I now have this Corollian 3D CFT that I've dimensionally reduced. You can kind of use that to track what you would expect from the OPEs. Would you, when the bulk is, say, a 4D CFT, or when you're doing perturbation theory around, say, the free theory, would you already have a sense of the full spectrum beyond the single particle states? Yes. If you wanted to really define an intrinsic dual, might it be more natural to look at, say, classifications of Corollian 3D CFTs? Sure. And so it's not so much that we're all like a stickler for saying it's a 2D CFT or codimension 2 CFT, that's what we mean by celestial. It's more that you get a surprising, like you can go a surprisingly far distance, taking very seriously conjectures that might be other questionable as far as like how much can I treat this like a radially quantized 2D CFT? And then you can take a step back and see, well, where do I expect them to break down from the construction that you have? And so just another little bit about Corollian. What's nice about it is that in some sense, maybe when you're looking at funny limits of what the speed of light would be, you would say, well, why would I care about a space-time that has c goes to zero? But in our sense, we see it because the conformal boundary is null. So there's a space-time living at the conformal boundary that is this funny, less physical thing for a very physical space-time, which is like asymptotically fast space-times, almost like the one we live in. And so that's one direction which I think is fun because you have people like Luca and Laura and others who are studying, and again, many other people, studying Corollian CFTs. And what I personally want to try to bridge with is this notion of the hard charges in our story being the same as the light ray operators that the people in the bootstrap literature study. And so I won't go too far into it, but basically roughly the example of the supertranslation charge, the operator that's appearing in this like Ward identity, you have the soft assertion, and the thing that's transforming the hard particles, the matter particles, and also like the highly energetic gravitons, is the Anik operator, the shear inclusive Anik operator if you include the finite energy gravitons. And so these guys have been studied on their own right in various contexts, like Hoffman-Maldacena is a nice example where they're using it to bootstrap certain UFRC terms. And so what's neat about it is that on the one hand, these objects kind of been studied in their own right and somewhat accidentally are the same boost eigenstates. But they're also looking at them in different contexts. So they would normally be looking at some operator, I guess I put in my origin, and then I sum over any outstate that could happen, and I look at correlation functions of these guys. But in the end, if they care about the OPE, that's the same like operator product of the operators that we care about in celestial CFT, but now including multiparticle states. And so you're seeing basically the part of the celestial amplitudes that you wouldn't see in perturbation theory because the Anik operator would annihilate the vacuum, but you still need it for these like general inclusive processes as kind of people, like you can co-opt their higher loop order results or other kind of computations of OPEs of these boost eigenstate operators and fill in more of the celestial dictionary just by understanding how those two fields are related, which is nice. And so personally, I like these Anik-like operators or the other like hard charges that appear because they're kind of at this bridge between being the hard charge that you see in the celestial symmetries, being objects that have been used a lot in the bootstrap literature, and also because of certain positivity conditions appearing a lot in the quantum information literature. And so if I want to view celestiography not as this origin story from the astrometry group, but rather as we all are interested in 4D, or we can do higher D too, asymptotically flat space times and how they're holographic, then there should be a nice collision of a lot of really cool research programs. And so there's still a lot of questions to be answered and a lot of awesome people who are trying to. And so please join us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Are there two questions from online? Can you please read them?
So there's a question by Nazir asking that in a past talk, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. In a past talk, I've heard the celestial holography certain techniques and approaches similar to bootstrap methods in QFT. Can Sabrina briefly explain what some of the techniques from the bootstrap approach are? And which one of those are related to this program and the recommendation to learn more about it?
Okay, so what I would try to decouple is the following. So for me, there's a couple things that celestial gets knocked for. The first thing is you're just talking about symmetries, and the second thing is what new have you taught us? So we're the first one, we're basically trying to find like larger symmetry multiplets that you can use. And so I would say a lot of the time that I've spent has been complementary to the bootstrap program because I'm trying to basically identify larger symmetry multiplets. Like the analog of Virasoro versus SL2C blocks would be like BMS instead of Poincaré. And so to that extent, I would say it's more like we're waiting to invite the bootstrappers to then be able to like look at the CIJKs of the operators in front of those larger multiplets. But on the flip side, there is a literal kinematic connection of the fact that they're looking at ANIC operators and we're using the same hard charges. And so I personally am like happy to be reading more about like the light ray OP papers and also various like detector operator papers, because they're also looking at observables at null infinity that are IR finite. So I think, I don't know if I fully answered your question or if I evaded something. I'm happy to revisit if I evaded. Good.
There's another question related. Yep. So it's Anthony Canazas Correa asking, what would be the difficulties in trying to generalize celestial holography to higher, lower dimensions?
Okay, that's always fun. So the difficulty of going lower D is, I think, a historical one, to the extent where we were really had a crutch, like this asymptotic symmetry story. So if we didn't have, the asymptotic symmetry was fine, but the soft theorem part. I think that now, lower D is probably easier, and you could say stronger things in lower D than even in 4D. Going to higher D, I think that the cute thing is the Carolean picture, because to what extent do you expect there, like maybe people would say, well, the only thing interesting is because it's a 2D theory, and then in 2D you can have SL2C go to Virasoro. But for CFTs on a null surface, you now have super translations, which I think you can extend to higher D. And so it's kind of fun to see that there is kind of, if you don't take what your CFT kind of knowledge too strongly in the sense of like, okay, what if I generalize this? What if I put it now on a null surface? You can see that there's enhancements there. So I think that's super exciting to just play with more formally. Does that answer the question? I think that answers the question, yeah.
Yeah, so since you have the much bigger symmetry algebra, and in principle, I guess they should be coming some sort of in representations for this symmetry algebra, would you expect at some point constraints on masses or couplings just from things falling in representations?
So for example, I don't want to be able to make as strong a claim as the, like I feel like, okay, so what I want to say is that part of, I would like to say that at some point, whatever you guys are doing for the swampland, like however you're going to say the UV behavior then gets imparted into the analytic structure of the boost weight story in my picture, would be where I would be able to start making those type of statements. Because right now, I think there was one conjecture about like if you really force these operator, the celestial operator algebras to exist, then you can try to constrain the EFT coefficients, but that might be too strong because for me, I really don't care that this W infinity is still there. I just care that I have an operator product to do the celestial kind of bootstrap analog story. So I would say we need to join forces with the swampland if we want to say anything about actually EFT coefficients, but.
Okay, last question, yes, please.
Yes, well, nice talk. Just a very naive point. How do you compare the duality compared with the ADA CFT? Yeah. In the sense of the other one, you have very well defined CFT, and you can say that there was an emergent spatial dimension, and you can compare the symmetry on both sides and so on. How different and how close you are for that?
Yeah. So my intuition is that anything that works in ADA CFT will roughly work for us up to subtleties about boundary conditions. And so, for example, the fact that it's codimension 2, I think, is an artifact of it being convenient to organize the 3D null surface in terms of its two-dimensional base where the metric is not degenerate. And then on top of that, you need to worry about matching in and out, and so the 2D picture also is kind of there to be glued to like whatever's happening at spatial infinity and time-like infinity. So I think the sense in which it's kind of a hologram is very similar in the sense that I'm happy to look at different cuts of view, but now you have to ask about boundary conditions. Now I have a leaky boundary condition. And so to the extent where I think the closest place where I would be concerned is if I have certain objects that I want to land on radiative solutions in the flat limit, there are things that I expect to be singular in the coupling in the cosmological constant. And so if I could do ADA CFT with the most relaxed boundary conditions I ever wanted, so that I know that I have the right phase space to be able to land on the asymptotic boundary conditions that I want in the flat limit, then I think it would follow through. But that's where the kind of the richness is, I think.
You said, but emergent dimensions would be what?
My intuition is that anything that you can do in ADA CFT, I can tell you how it works in the flat limit. So for example, like I think a lot of the reason why you can take like Shoda's result or other, like Hijano looking at, say, finding S matrix elements from correlators in ADS CFT is fine because there I'm perturbing around the global ADS, which becomes on my flat background. But that if I wanted to land on solutions with radiation, I might, in the description of, like, say, the Brauner stress sensor, have terms that are like 1 over the cosmological constant, which are going to be singular in that limit. And so there are boundary conditions that might be physical for you from ADS that would be over restrictive and kill things in the flat limit.
Okay, let us thank Sabrine again. Okay.